This is the fourth tape in a series by Thomas V. Taylor, Associate Professor of Church History and Old Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary.
Now, when Henry changed his position with the church, that didn't change his personal feelings toward Tyndale or Luther. He always hated Luther with a passion. And Luther hated him, too. Luther called him the fat pig of England and things of that sort designed to placate him, you know. Luther described Henry VIII in ferocious language and vice versa. You see, the problem, I think, who knows where his heart was, but I would say that there was nothing to indicate that Henry's heart had been touched by the gospel or justification by faith. What had been touched was his national pride and his political ambition. That's what I think. And consequently, even after he left the Roman Church, he maintained exactly the same attitudes toward Tyndale and Luther. Although if either one of them had suddenly shown up and said, here's 10,000 ducats for your next party, he might have liked them. There just was nothing to indicate that he had a redemptive type of experience, I think. But outside the church, he quickly enacted a number of parliamentary laws. His marriage to Anne didn't last very long. When I say parliamentary laws, I just kind of blow by that. But he came through eventually with what would be called the Six Articles and then the Ten Articles, both to free the English church and then to kind of tie it up. He permitted the English clergy to marry. In 1537, he divorced Anne. He had her executed. He didn't have to really divorce her. He had her executed, so she was gone. Henry would go through several wives. I don't even like to go over them because it's one of those grisly things that I kind of like to forget. But he would go through several wives. A couple of them had the good fortune to outlive him, looking for the male heir. He had a daughter, Mary, by Catherine of Aragon, and he would have a daughter by Anne Boleyn. She will be Queen Elizabeth someday. And he will have a son by Jane Seymour, who will be Edward VII. So, as I mentioned, with a number of parliamentary moves, he consolidated himself. He established himself outside the Roman Church. He permitted the clergy to marry. Went through all these wives. I've always felt sorry for, well, not, it's hard to say, but in his desperation for a male heir, he was looking for another wife to marry after Jane Seymour had lost his favor. Thomas Cranmer had suggested the original divorce thing. Cranmer was kind of Henry's chief of state, and Cranmer had become the Archbishop of Canterbury. Too complicated to say how. But Cromwell had been on the continent and had seen a woman whom he thought was ravishingly beautiful. That is, he had seen her picture. And so he showed Henry her picture and suggested, since she was the daughter of German nobility, he suggested that that would be a nice wife for Henry. Henry looked at her picture and blinked twice and thought it would be a great idea. So they arranged a wedding for Henry with Anne of Cleves. Cleves, one of the Dutch territories. They arranged a wedding with Anne of Cleves. It's one of those cases where Anne of Cleves had a wonderful artist, but not much else going for her. Henry never saw her. She came to England and stayed in one of the castles in England till the wedding, see, but Henry was so overwhelmed with a desire to know whom he was going to marry and see this beautiful woman whose picture had ravished his heart, he was so overwhelmed by it that he disguised himself with a couple of his guides, went on some errand to the castle just on some pretense, not letting, you know, and caught a peep of Anne of Cleves, and he discovered that the artist was far better at creating than at portraying. She was homely. Nice, though, and a very fine Christian, I think, but homely. And not just homely like you think of homely. I don't know what to say. I'm a homely guy myself. What should I say? She was definitely not going to win any Miss projects, unless it was Miss Highbridge Nose or something like that. Henry could hardly face the wedding. He confessed that he was sick at the thought of it. But there was no way out of it without having a war. He actually married her. It seems doubtful that they ever really lived together. And in a few months, Henry gave her a giant castle in the country and a lot of money and a lot of other things and just announced that that marriage didn't amount to anything. Anne didn't want to go home and look embarrassing to go back home, so she spent the rest of her days happily living in a castle out in the country and had a big staff and all the other things. No, she was a good woman, but not particularly good-looking, so Henry divested himself of her and continued on that project. He never got the heir that he wanted in a son. I hate to dabble with his life like that, but that's pretty much the way it went. His child, Elizabeth, the daughter of Anne Boleyn, would actually in time be the son that Henry wanted. Do you know what I mean by that? She was a lady, and a very feminine lady. She was not the type that went around smoking a cheroot and knocking ashes on the top of Sir Walter Raleigh's head. She was a very feminine person, but a strong-willed, domineering, absolutely sure of what she wanted and knew how to get it kind of a person who would for 40 years control most of the rulers of Europe one way or another. She was an excellent leader in the British Empire. It's ironic, but in Great Britain, there have never been any two rulers better than Queen Elizabeth and Queen Victoria. They undoubtedly were the makers of England and much of whatever it came out to be. Let me mention a few things about Henry's developed concepts. His religious experience of page 9, as I mentioned, was virtually, I would say, nil. But if you get to heaven and find out he's got one of the great saints, got a throne with all the great saints, just, you know, the Lord knows. Around him clustered the chief men of the English Reformation. The most important of them is Thomas Cranmer. C-R-A-N-M-E-R, Cranmer. Because after Henry's death, he will structure the English Reformation. He will produce the great mass of Protestant literature. And he will bring the Protestant clergy. Cranmer is a man who understands redemptive truths. But he is also a politician. And if Henry said, be quiet, he knew how to be quiet. But Cranmer will be the chief man of the English Reformation. There will be several others along with him that I will just pass away from. I'll go to page 10 and mention Edward VII. Edward VII was only 7 years old when Henry died. He had always been a sickly child. Lots of children are sickly, though, so that doesn't tell you a lot in itself. Have any of you read Twain's Prince and the Pauper? Yeah, see, well, the prince is Edward VII and the Prince and the Pauper. He looks a lot better in The Prince and the Pauper than he ever looked in real life. He does seem to have been, forgive me, a nice little boy. But at 7, he was hardly equipped to be king, although he was crowned king, and Lord Northampton and various other ones were guardians for him, and Cranmer was his tutor. During his time, only 6 years, he ruled to 1553, that's all, 1547 to 1553. During that time, they came out with new hymnals, new prayer books, new Bible translations, a whole bunch of things, mostly under the direction of Cranmer. And England moved between 1553 and 1547. Put those in reverse order. Between 1547 and 1553, England moved very much in a Reformation direction. It perhaps didn't go far enough, but there were lots of good preachers. Universities of Oxford and Cambridge became centers of truth, and it moved that way. But in 1553, Edward VII died. Today, most scholars think it was tuberculosis or some disease like that. He was always sickly, color never good, and in 1553, he died. When he died, there were two children of Henry VIII's living. One of them was Mary Tudor, and the other one would be Elizabeth. Tudor was the surname of the Henry family. Henry Tudor, Four-Door, Six-Door, Mary Tudor. Mary was the oldest of his living children, and she was obviously the legal heir to the throne. Even though he had had her mother's wedding annulled and had kept her locked up in a kind of a house arrest all these years. Now, some people tried to bring Lady Jane Grey to the throne and others because she was a half-cousin, but none of those plots worked. The English, with their love of majesty and monarchy, brought Mary to the throne. Now, Mary was a solid Catholic. You could not have been more Catholic than she was, Roman Catholic. She had seen her mother disgraced. She'd seen her own life made miserable. She hated Protestantism. And, of course, she hated her father like you can hardly believe. Now, you may not sympathize with what she did, but you can understand how it happened, I think. She hated him with a vengeance and hated all he stood for. And she was determined to bring England back to the Roman Church. She made a couple of unwise moves. The first of them was marrying Philip II of Spain. They were hardly married in anything more than name. And you see, Philip II of Spain would have been a second cousin, as my father would say, twice removed and once buried. But he would be a distant relative. Philip of Spain was the son of Charles V. And so he is a distant relative to her. He is hated in England. He's the man who eventually will launch the Armada against England, but he's hated in England. And it was a very unpopular marriage. But then she launched out with a vigorous persecution against the Protestant reformers. and more than 300 of them were burned at the stake in the six-year period, among them Thomas Cranmer. She really had it in for him. Cranmer in prison, under death threat, actually recanted the faith that he had announced in Henry's days. He actually recanted it, signed a paper that he was loyal to the church, the Roman church. He was an old man under threat. You know, funny things happen. But they weren't going to free Cranmer if he had, you know, if he had suddenly turned into Saint Bartholomew. His days were done. And when Cranmer realized that he was going to die anyway, he recanted the recantation. And it's a kind of a gripping thing in church history that as they tied into the stake and piled the faggots around him and set them on fire, these persons were usually bound heavily at the waist, but they were usually allowed to have their limbs free so they could watch them in their agony squirm. It's an unbelievable kind of a thing. But as the faggots were lit around Cranmer, with a loud voice, they say, he stuck his right hand into the fire and he said that this hand that had betrayed him would be the first to feel the heat of the flame. It's hard to know if that's actually, but that was the testimonial. But more than 300 died. Now, the funny thing with England was they were used to having people thrown in jail. They could live with that. Having people exiled, they could live with that. But England was not used to a lot of this sort of thing. And consequently, Mary succeeded very quickly in turning the English populace against her 100%. Between marrying this Philip and having a bloodbath of martyrs, many of whom were very popular people and very nice people, between those two things, and burning some women merely because they had one page of the Bible in their kitchen and things like that, between the great number of martyrs, she made herself very unpopular. She would die in 1558, again of some illness. Nobody knows for sure. She, too, had been sickly. Half the people that lived in these days had been sickly. They hadn't had vitamin compounds invented yet. But she would die in 1558. Nobody shed a tear for her, not even Philip in Spain. He didn't like the idea anyway. He's afraid he might have to go and live in England. He couldn't stand the cold and the wet. So when she died in 1558, she died unwanted and unmourned. What a kind of an unhappy history. And after a brief argument over who would succeed her, she was succeeded by her sister Elizabeth, who was considerably younger and enormously talented. Elizabeth would become queen in 1558 and would rule England for the next 45 years. Of her capabilities, not too much can be said. She had the fine touch of knowing when to do things and how far to do them. She showed that very quickly when she became Queen of England by refusing to accept the title that her father had taken to himself for the church. Her father had called himself Supreme Head of the Church. Elizabeth said that only Christ was head of the church, but she would accept the title of Supreme Governor of the Church, the governor serving under the head. And believe it or not, a lot of little things like that, how she felt in her heart, who knows, but a lot of little things like that made her more acceptable to the public. And from 1558 to 1567, kind of, you know, just roughly, from 1558 to 1567, she just kind of, fooled around with the religious issue, so that for those years, nobody was exactly certain whether she was going to follow Mary in being loyal to the Roman church, or the persecution stopped. But for about 8 or 9 years, nobody was really certain what she was going to do. She permitted servants to continue having a mass at the castle if they wanted to. She herself didn't go, but she permitted it. So for 7 or 8 years, she hedged. While she got Parliament thinking her way and working her way, the Pope didn't want to condemn her immediately. It took him about 9 years. By the time he did it, he was about 8 years too late to have any real effect. But she took about 9 years. See, I've said 7 or 8 or 9. How's that for generalities? But 1567 is a good terminal year. Until 1567, there was considerable doubt how she would go. But then it became apparent that she was going with the Protestant movement, the Articles of the Church of England. There had been 42 of them originally. They were now redrafted as 39. And it became apparent that she was going with the Reformation movement. And so the Pope had excommunicated her. He reaffirmed that. He called for her overthrow. The King of Spain announced that he would lead a holy war against England, which he eventually did. It didn't go very far. It kind of ended in the English Channel. But he announced he would lead it. And Mary had broken with the Roman Church. England was outside the system, and it established a church of its own, which we will call, throughout the rest of history, the Anglican Church. for the Church of England. Yeah, Philip would make a big attempt. I'll say something about that in a later class, probably. Philip would make a big attempt to reconquer England. Not really. I mean, he never got to England, or he never conquered it. They would make a big attempt to suppress it without much success. And Elizabeth would succeed in getting all of these guys, about half of whom thought that she would marry them someday. Apparently, she never had that in her mind, but she managed to... Fellows like Sir Walter Raleigh and Francis Drake and Francis Asnell and a whole bunch of guys. She got a whole bunch of those guys who were heroes for England and for her, too. England is a small country. They would soon make her rich by... The Spaniards were over here stealing the gold from the Indians. England didn't bother stealing the gold from the Indians. They waited on the high seas and stole it from the Spanish. I used to wonder how they could do it. Then I realized that it took a lot to sink those old tubs because they didn't have the exploding cannon we had today. And unless somebody had enough nerve to fire off a ton of powder, you know, just blow it up, you could just knock them all apart. They'd float around for a while, and the Englishmen would board them, and they'd fight it out, and then they'd grab the gold. So the English sea captains just pirated the Spanish fleets like crazy. And since there was no radio, if all the ships were sunk and all the men were dead, who knew what happened to it? You know, there are big storms in the Caribbean. That's the way it went. Francis Drake would come back to England, and these guys, they'd come back to England loaded with gold so much that their ships would kind of wallow in it. And everybody knew perfectly well where it came from. Some of it might have had the King of Spain's picture on it. But the Queen would greet them happily, take her share, and eventually knight most of them for their courage for the crown and inspire them to go out and get more. Oh, it was a great age. It's the age of Shakespeare and the age of Ben Jonson and the age of Spencer and all those guys. And if you read Shakespeare and Jonson and Spencer, if you ever get really hard up for reading, you read those fellows, you'll discover that they adored the Queen. She captivated the nation like her father had, although she is moral and decent, and he was not. On the other hand, she doesn't go out wrestling thugs in the lawn at the court either. She's quite different that way. But she's got that charisma of person that makes the nation follow her. But I hope you can see the difference in the English Reformation and the Continental Reformation. I stressed that last week and the week before just a little bit. Hope you can see that. Hope you can see the difference essentially in the spiritual life of England. It would come to flourish, and England would become a spiritual leader, but it didn't start that way. I hope also you can see the differences in the emphasis of Calvin and Luther and Zwingli and Menno Simons in particular. I hope you can see that. That's rather important because the Reformation is a composite sort of affair. It wasn't that six men sat down in a delicatessen and planned how to stage it. The chief men in it actually had relatively little contact with one another and relatively little contact that was favorable. Relatively little. They certainly knew of each other and knew about each other. The chief men in it actually knew each other very slightly. Luther certainly knew Zwingli. They didn't like each other at all, hardly. Luther thought of Zwingli as being snobbish and too proud of his classical learning. Luther and Zwingli thought of Luther as having poor manners and various other things. Calvin was a little later than either of those men, so he only really knew them by writing. He overlapped them, but he overlapped them just slightly, like a younger man does an older man. He was almost a generation behind in some ways. But likewise, he had relatively little contact with either directly. Menno Simons was diametrically opposed to them on many points of life and issues. And if you name the other 8 or 10 reformers who were prominent, Martin Bucer and Farel, you'd find that they touched on men, but you'd find there's very little among them that could be called collusion. I'd say that they all really had a common love for the gospel. I don't doubt that for a minute. But they had individual understandings of what was important and what wasn't important that were quite different. And the method of operation was quite different, too. Zwingli was ready to get the army and attack. Luther was ready to let the king do that. Men like Calvin felt there was nothing to be gained in doing that. Menno Simons felt that the best thing to do was to hide from doing it. And I only mention those four men because they're names that we've emphasized as we move through the course to some degree. So the Reformation is a composite sort of thing of many different people, many different interests, about the only things they really had in common. One was the essential concept of justification by faith, and two, the essential concept that the Word of God was the strong authority for the Church. Those are about the only things they had in common. They disagreed sociologically and practically, but those two things they had in common, and those two things worked together to weld the Reformation. The Reformation was never what you'd call a planned movement. It was an incidental movement almost. And that's why fellows like myself have said that it had to be of God. Men couldn't possibly have inspired it or brought it to pass. They didn't have the planning capacity and didn't have the physical capacity to do it either. Every force in the world was against them in terms of military strength until they began to convert a few. They had no real background in the educational universe. There wasn't, in Europe in 1500, there wasn't a university that could be called reformationistic in scope. There wouldn't be any until they would start them. So the movement really was almost grassroots, but from different backgrounds and from different forms, and yet it kind of all pooled together into a rebirth in the interest in the gospel. We'd be mistaken if we said they were all dedicated Christians. That's hardly true in any age. The Lord had 12 disciples, and one of those was not so good, you know. In any age, we always have a certain number of pretensions. But they did a great deal in revitalizing the gospel and making it thrive in the territory where it was. And so in our last class, I went rapidly through the English kings, having passed by Henry VIII and Edward VII and Mary Tudor, who's sometimes called Bloody Mary, and then Queen Elizabeth. And I emphasized that Elizabeth would not be called head of the church. She would, however, be called the supreme governor. She said only Christ was the head. She would not accept that title. She would be the supreme governor of the church. She would appoint a number of Anglican leaders, and the Anglican church, in a practical way, this isn't technically true, but in a practical way, the Anglican church dates from Elizabeth's reign. It actually is somewhat older than that, in that it was formed in the days of Edward VII under Cranmer and those men with the 42 articles. But in a practical way, it was given its historic footing in the days of Queen Elizabeth. If you were like my grandfather, I don't mean to be offensive, so just be patient with me. My grandfather was of the high Anglican party who argued that the true church was the Church of England and that it antedated the Roman church in many ways. He was of the high Anglican party. I remember being in the store in Cooperstown, Pennsylvania, which is out in the woods, it's near Pittsburgh, but still out in the woods. Today the world is growing up, but in Middlesex Township there were like 230 residents when we first moved there. The township was 36 square miles, 230 residents is not many, no matter how you count it. And sometime about the close of the Second World War, the Roman Catholics in the community, they had no church for 30 miles, began to build a church in Cooperstown, which they called Holy Sepulchre. And misspelling sepulchre always irritated me, but that's how they spelled it. Holy Sepulchre. They met in the foundation of a house and the foundation of a building about 2 miles from the heart of Cooperstown. Since Cooperstown only had one store and 6 houses and a church, 2 miles from the heart of it was still not much of any place. And my grandfather and I were in the store one day when two priests came in. I was in high school, 14 or 15. Two priests came in. They said to the storekeeper, they asked him where the Catholic church was. And the storekeeper said that he didn't get around very much, which was true. He said, I've heard there is one, but he said, I don't know where it is. But he said, Mr. Brown here knows every building in the township. That was also true. He said, Mr. Brown knows every building in the township. So they looked at my grandfather and respectfully asked if he could tell them where the Catholic church was. He looked them right in the eye, and he said, well, there's a little mission in Mars twice a month, he said. Sunday morning, they have Mass twice a month. And then he said, they mentioned a church in Butler in Pittsburgh, but he said, there's no Catholic church near here. And the priest, I was astounded, see, because the priest looked at him and said, is he sure? And my grandfather said, yes. He said he was the civil defense coordinator for the township. He said, I know every building in the township, every barn, every silo, he said, every chicken house. He said, there's no Catholic church in this township. And after looking perplexed, the priest said to him, he said, I don't mean to argue with you, sir, but he said, we have this letter from our superior, and he tells us that near Cooperstown is the Holy Sepulchre. My grandfather looked at them. Oh, he said, you mean the Roman Catholic Church. He said, I would never confuse the Catholic Church with the Roman Church, he said. Now, he said, there is a Roman church up the road about 2 miles called Holy Sepulchre. He said, they don't spell sepulchre right, but he said, they're up there 2 miles. My granddad was a little jolly man. And he said, if that's what you want, he said, I'm sorry. But he said, if you'd asked for the Roman church, he said, I would have told you right away where it was. But he says, it's up there. He said, of course, there's no Greek church here either. But he said, there is a Catholic church, meaning the Anglican mission in Mars twice a month, he said. The priest went out looking like they'd been whipped. And I, of course, had no knowledge at all of what he was talking about. I was a high school student. I just thought he was being smart with those guys. I learned as time went on what all that was in the background was. But the Anglican Church really gets established in Elizabeth's reign. In 1871 come the final excommunications against Elizabeth. She is out forever. See, they not only put you out of the church, but out of heaven. And some they even put out of purgatory into lower places. And the break is complete with the Roman Church by that time. Now I'm ready to move back onto the continent, unless you have some question or something that's problematic or that you'd like to ask about. I move back to the continent. In this course, we kind of move back and forth, because that's the way my notes go. And that, of course, is also the way history goes. When we come back to the continent, we go to the Low Countries. By the Low Countries, we mean the Netherlands countries. We mean, in particular, Holland. Holland is just one province in the Netherlands today. We mean, in particular, Holland and Belgium. The Flemish countries, that whole little complex of very interesting countries, the Low Countries. Called Low, you know why they're called Low, because of their proximity to sea level and because of the constant fighting they had with the seas surging in. Everybody's seen the dikes and the windmills of Holland keeping the seas out. Everybody knows that the Dutch boys grow with extra large thumbs so that they can use them on the dikes if they find breaks in them and things of that sort. The Low Countries. The Low Countries were always heavily populated. Among other reasons, it was excellent agricultural territory. Stuff would grow there that would hardly grow anyplace else. They don't do well with tomatoes. But I remember walking around the Netherlands looking at the cabbage and the Brussels sprouts and the beets and stuff like that with my eyes bulging. You can see, it's impressive. But it was a good farming country. In addition to that, they had easy access to the sea. Now, they had to use the North Sea and the British Channel. But when you pass by the North Sea and the British Channel, then you had all these many deep water ports in the Netherlands. There are quite a few. You'll think of Rotterdam and Amsterdam and a number of them. In addition to which, they were able to make use of the Zuiderzee, which was an inland sea, really, connected to the ocean, of course, but inland. Therefore, they had excellent shipping capacities. There were just lots of good places to dock your boat. And so the Netherlands easily became a merchandising center. It was technically, at the start of the Reformation period, just take 1500 for a good year, it was at that time under the control of the Spanish, and it would remain under the control of the Spanish for a good many years. The Spanish ruled as a colony, which they had inherited through kingly marriage. And until at least 1580 is a round number. Until 1580, the Spanish would be the dominant influence in the Netherlands. However, the Dutch were constantly irritated with them and constantly fighting against them. You'll discover that by 1531, the years aren't terribly important, folks. The feel of time is that. But see, 1531 is just 14 years after Luther's theses. And so you'll discover in 1531, there were already Bible translations in Dutch and a good deal of Christian literature in Dutch. Menno Simons would do his original writings in Dutch. Most of the reformers wrote in Latin, but Simons would write in Dutch because that was native tongue to him. And by 1561, there would be a Dutch confession. It's known today as the Belgic, B-E-L-G-I-C, the Belgic Confession by 1561. But the Spanish still controlled the Netherlands, and the Spanish put down Protestantism as much as they could. Now, the Netherlands is not a terribly big place, but big enough with the rivers and the dikes and the fjords and the different lands and four different languages extant at that time, between the Dutch and the French and the Flemish, whatever that other language is, it just dropped out of my head, that's spoken in the northern sections of the Netherlands yet to this day. Frisian. You know, they're Frisian cattle. I went up to Frisia to see the Frisian cattle, just on a little junket one day. You can almost bicycle from one end of the Netherlands to the other in one day if you're a good cyclist. I was over there failing to realize the smallness of the company and wanting to see Cornelius Vormerdam's work. And standing at the train station and asking the fellow how to get there. And a man said to me, I only had one day. He said, you don't want to go there in one day. He said, it's all the way to Germany, he said. He said, it'd be a terrible trip. He said, you'd spend all day traveling. So I took his advice and didn't go. But when I looked at the map that night, I saw that all the way to Germany was 35 miles. 35 miles. You move into small countries. I wasn't planning to walk it, you know. I thought there'd be a train there. But Vormerdam's work continued without my visit. So the Dutch constantly protested, and the Spanish kept armies there. The last non-Italian pope until the present pope, Adrian VI, was a Dutchman. He was from Netherlands. And Charles V, the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, had been raised there a great deal. He kind of liked the Netherlands and wanted to keep them. But by 1573, one of the Dutch rulers, William of Orange, in 1573, professed to be converted and joined the Reformed churches in the Netherlands. William of Orange. Now, William of Orange is enormously important. He had been a confidant of the emperor. He had been a staunch Roman Catholic. He was a Dutchman admired throughout most of the Netherlands. And so in 1573, he joined the Reformed church, and he led a revolt against the Spanish. And for the next 11 years, till 1584, he was assassinated in 84. But for the next 11 years, he united the Dutch, won battles against the Spanish. He was helped winning the battles against the Spanish because Philip II, King of Spain, I already mentioned him with regard to England, was a bungler, and replaced generals on whims and on the stars, astrology and stuff like that. Consequently, he often replaced a good general and replaced him with some dud who hardly knew how to march. When I say often, I couldn't tell you how often, but enough to keep the Protestants on top in the Netherlands. And the result was that for all intents and purposes, by 1580, they were virtually free of the Spanish influence. In 1584, though, William of Orange was assassinated, but he had brought them to a point of stability where they could continue on themselves. The Netherlands divided. They divided the northern section being intensely Protestant, the southern section being intensely Catholic. But they did something that almost no other place in Europe did at that time. They tolerated each other within their bounds. So in what today we would call Belgium, you would find some Protestant congregations, and what we call the Netherlands, you would find some Catholic congregations. But the Netherlands proper became Protestant, and Belgium and Flemish territories remained loyal to the Roman Church, held pretty tightly by the armies of Spain and the Empire. Now, the Dutch never got free from war exactly. They would still be fighting in 1609, fighting revolutions among themselves and fighting civil war among themselves, but they maintained themselves independent of the Roman system quite well after about 1580. Belgium remained in the Catholic circle and would be there to this day, and along with that, of course, would be Luxembourg. Luxembourg. Have you read the article on the big computer in Luxembourg called The Beast? Have you read that? See, I'm always appalled by these. I never know what to say. I always want to know the facts. So I have a missionary friend who works in Luxembourg. He's native European, so he's in Luxembourg a great deal of the time, and I said to him, had he heard of this great beast, this great computer that they called The Beast? And he said to me with a smile, he said, yes, he said, some call it a beast, and he said, what some call it couldn't be said in public, he said. He said, it depends on who you're talking to, what it's called, he said. And I said, yeah, some Protestant passing by heard some Dutchman call it the beast, and thought immediately he was living in the Revelation Age. This fellow said, no, he said, they have a lot of other names for it, too. A big mercantile computer, especially, he said, when it gets the common market prices followed up, he said, they call it a lot of things.
President, that beast has every financial transaction
in the whole world. That's right. This fellow said to me, well, you never can tell. But my originally, the first tract I got said it was not in Luxembourg, but in Brussels. But it's not in Brussels. It's in Luxembourg. The guy that wrote the first tract heard somebody say that. And that's the way it goes. Well, I mentioned the Low Countries. They divided that way, and they stayed that division to this day. Then I moved to Scandinavia. Denmark was the leading country in Scandinavia, and the Reformation came to Denmark in force between 1518 and 1533. If I were to tell you all the intrigue of the Danish kings, they all had good names, King Christian. Several of the Danish kings are called Christian, Christian first, second, third, fourth, up to this present century. But they all had good names. But the Danish kings tend to be chameleon-like people. They could change sides and loyalties freely. When Christian II was deposed in 1523, partly because of difficulties that he had pushed on other Scandinavian countries, he was succeeded by Frederick I, who was a strong Protestant, 1523. And Frederick I succeeded in having more missionaries from Luther, in particular the famous Danish missionary Hans Tausen. Tausen, just for the sake of record, is spelled T-A-U-S-E-N, one S, I think. Tausen. Of course, it wasn't an immediate transformation in Denmark either. People become loyal to a system. If the king is popular enough, as Henry VIII was, to make the system look bad, then the people will follow the king. Frederick I led Denmark out of the reform circles. Tausen preached the gospel. And Denmark became a Lutheran country after the pattern of Lutheran's Reformation, certainly by 1533, and never really vacillated again after that. Never vacillated. You could say that the Danish state church came to pass about 1536. Norway. Norway was always the poor cousin. If you're Norwegian, forgive me. When Ronald Perry was a student here, his wife was Norwegian. He was an Italian, but his wife was Norwegian. And so he was very much interested in Norwegian backgrounds. Norway's an interesting country. I haven't been there. I just read the books, look at the pictures, like to go, talk to Norwegians. But in the Scandinavian League, it was always the weak sister because it is an enormously cold country. If it weren't for the Gulf Stream warming the shores of it a little bit, it would be an icy wasteland almost. It's hard to believe how far north it is. You just have to get out your own map and follow the gizmo ghoulies around the map to see how far north it is. I mean the latitudinal lines, of course, by gizmo ghoulies. It's really extremely north. We used to play all those questions. Is London further north than New York and all that kind of stuff? It's a lot further north than New York, London is. And Norway is a lot further north than New London. It's parallel to Newfoundland and territories like that. But the Gulf Stream moves over there and warms it up a little bit, and the sardines live in the fjords, and so Norway has always had a nice settled country, but always the weak sister from the point of view of not having a strong population. As I said before, the Vikings that did such terrible carnage, in your mind a lot of times you think of them as coming from Norway, but the truth is that 95% of them came from Denmark. They went down south to sell cheese and had parties after they sold it, but most of the Vikings were Danes. Norwegians could hardly sail across the North Sea, but the Danes had controlled Norway for a long, long time. So when Denmark became Christian, the king of Denmark eventually would simply decree that Norway would become a Christian too. That decree would be given under Christian III of Denmark after 1533. He would decree that they become Christian by 1569. The dates don't mean a lot if you see the flow, but by 1569, Norway would have its own Lutheran confession. And it would have a state church. It would forbid any entrance of Jesuit or Catholic missionaries, an act that they didn't change until 1956. Until 1956, no Jesuits were allowed in Norway. In 1956, they ended the state church and did away with a lot of other religious acts too. Of all the Scandinavian churches, the Norwegian church tended to be the most faithful to essential Lutheranism. Lots of good leaders have come from it, and lots of missionaries in various mission movements in the last 100 years, certainly over its whole history. But it tended to remain faithful to an essential Lutheranism far better than the Danish church or the Swedish church did. Then I mentioned Sweden. So the history of Sweden in the Reformation is a fascinating one. I touched on it here one day when I talked about the spread of Luther's ideas. But the big mover in Sweden was a king named Gustavus Vasa. Vasa is spelled V-A-S-A. Who by 1530 had established the Reformation pretty well in Sweden. He first had to get rid of the Danes. The Danes had really been struggling to hold Sweden under their thumb. Christian II had committed great atrocities in Sweden, and that was part of the reason he was deposed as king in favor of Frederick I. But Gustavus Vasa felt a successful war in getting rid of the Danes, establishing Sweden as a national power. And he equipped for service in Sweden in particular ways the two Petri brothers, P-E-T-R-I. They were the big reformers in Sweden, the Petri brothers. From 1560, when Vasa died, the next few years, there was considerable controversy. The Jesuits tried to come in and turn it over. But about 1593, after about 30 years of up and downs, about 1593, the Duke of Söderlund became king of Sweden, and thereafter it became the strongest of all the Lutheran countries in Europe. Sweden would become the strongest of all the Lutheran countries. Now, the Swedish church would begin to follow modern liberalism in the last century. And, of course, today it is overrun with it. But it became the strongest single Lutheran country in Europe. And in the Thirty Years' War, around 1530, if it hadn't been for the Swedish armies, it's hard to tell where European Protestantism would have gone. I said to one of my Swedish colleagues years ago, I said, why was it that the Danes, you know, the Vikings and the Swedes, I said, why was it that they were always going out and making war on other people? And he said to me, well, he said, they're only about 2 months of the year when it's fit to live there, he said, so the other 10 months you go someplace else. He said, if you've got the money, he said, you go and steal. So he thought that was why the Vikings, he thought it was a sociological problem, and they came home for a couple summer months, and then they went out on the prowl again. Well, whatever the case, all three of those countries became substantially Lutheran and Protestant along those lines. France has an interesting history, much more interesting than I can do justice to in the time I've allotted to it in my discussion. But France really has an interesting phase of history, and I mention it on page 10 and also on 11 and 12. I've gotten Francis I in here twice. He deserves to be in two or three times. I mention him first of all on page 10 on the development of France in the 16th century. Maybe you're more up on European history than I am, but if you're not, You'll remember that France gained its national entity about 500 A.D. under a man named Clovis. Give or take a few years, Clovis merged the Franks. And then his line were great French kings, culminating eventually in Charlemagne. Charlemagne was not his line, but after Clovis's conquest, Charlemagne's family kind of moved his out peacefully over 150 years. But Charlemagne was the capstone of the French kings. He had a gigantic area in which he controlled. But Charlemagne had no worthy successors for the next many years. We used to say humorously he was succeeded by a bunch of fellows known as Charles the Bold, Charles the Short, Louis the Fat, Louis the Simple, a bunch of other fellows like that. Whether their names fit them or not is beside the point. But France went back into, may we say back, it went into a secondary position from Charlemagne, that's 800, to about 1200. About 1200 AD, France began merging again. And in the 13th century, it was probably the 14th century, the 1300s, it was probably the strongest power in Europe in the 1300s. And then it went into a period of decline, kingly pursuits and difficulties, and particularly a long war with England, a 100 years war with England. They fought back and forth and back and forth. England controlled part of France, which is called Brittany. They did that legitimately, but they wanted to control more. You remember that Joan of Arc was fighting the British, or leading the French forces against the British. So they really fought for about 100 years, wearing themselves out, fighting back and forth. It was kind of like the warfare that Iran and Iraq are carrying on today. It wasn't always a super pitched battle, but armies were constantly being gotten to go and take this place and navies to go and assault that place and all sorts of things. Unbelievable period. So in the 15th century, France really sank back into a desperate situation. At the start of the century of the Reformation, the king who is most meaningful to us is Francis I from about 1515. I described him here one day. I said he was utterly without principle. That's true. He was immoral and profane. All of that's true. However, he was capable. You know, he could have run the newsstand well. He was capable as far as an administrator was concerned and a policymaker, and was a kind of a popular hero in spite of himself in France. So Francis I is the key man in the development of France in the 16th century, and what he was sold on was that France should become the dominant power of Europe. He would not have it subservient to the church or to the empire, and certainly not to Germany. But Germany, see, at this time was a bunch of loosely confederated states. So Francis's goal was that France would be the dominant force in the empire. Some of the kings immediately before him, and he himself, promoted that by the building of universities. And out of those universities came what I call the humanistic evangelical movements among the French. I have several times gone over this concept of humanism with you. You have to remember that the humanism of the Reformation is quite different than the humanism of today or of ancient Greece. The humanism of the Reformation saw a man as being worthwhile, and they wanted him to have a decent shake in life. So all the reformers are called humanists if you go to the right schools. They're all called humanists. But in France, because of the university system and because of the rivalry of them, this is a hard thing to see in art. Well, maybe it isn't so hard. See, France is not a large country either, but it's large if you have to walk through it. So places like in Lyon, the University in Lyon, the University in Paris, universities would hunger for students. Hence they became pocketed centers from students from anywhere who could work with Latin, work with French. And sometimes in trying to build their reputations, they would take extremists because extremists draw students. Nobody goes to study with Harvey Muddle. They go to study with somebody who's got an electric personality, and he draws students. And consequently, the French king, to see the universities grow, was prone to put up with a lot of stuff that other European kings wouldn't have put up with. Francis is a good example of that. His immediate successors were too. Predecessors were also. Consequently, you have a man like Jacques Lefebvre. Jacques Lefebvre teaching at the Sorbonne in the University of Paris around 1500, a few years before that, a few years after that. But Lefebvre is a thorough evangelical. He precedes Luther. He's within the Roman Church. But his teachings are evangelical, critical of the Church, critical of the Pope, critical of those things to a point that you could hardly believe it. And in that connection, there was a strong humanistic evangelical movement in France, particularly among the university students and among the courtly students. Now, Francis I's own sister, Marguerite, became a Christian. Used her palace and her house and her family to harbor Christians and those fleeing the Roman Church until she died. And as I said earlier, Francis had almost nothing about him that you would admire. One thing I guess he did have was kind of nice. He was loyal to his family. And so when somebody would come to him and say, your sister is harboring a bunch of Protestants, I don't know what they said. I'm just making it up. But I know what he did. When somebody said, your sister is harvesting Protestants, Francis just kind of looked at him and said, nobody tells lies about my sister. He about spoken his last words right there. He just wouldn't take that sort of an interference, I think. And so Marguerite made no secret about her evangelical pretensions, at least not no open secret, you know. She didn't run around giving out tracts in the subway, but she was openly friendly to the evangelicals, and they adored her court. And Francis tolerated that because she was his sister. If she'd been some strange woman come by, it's hard to tell what he would have done. But there was a great movement in the humanistic evangelicalism in France at this particular period. On page 11, I mention the court of Francis I again because I want to emphasize something in connection with that. And that was that he could tolerate anything that didn't really challenge his stability as king or the reign of his court. So he could have Christians serving him. I mean, by Christians, I mean evangelicals of the Lutheran sort. There are no doubt Christians in the Roman See and other places too. But he could tolerate them serving him in his court because his court was a kind of a cosmopolitan thing. The only thing that mattered in his court was, are you for the French? Consequently, his court, rather than serving, I don't want to give a poor picture of this, but his court, rather than serving as a vigilant place for stamping out Protestants, his court actually tolerated them as long as they didn't threaten the security of the French throne or didn't write too many articles on the evils of a licentious king. You have to be careful what you write on. I'll come to Scotland after a while. I have it under a separate heading. And when we get to Scotland, I'll point out that John Knox thought the worst thing in the world that could happen was to have a woman for a queen. I mean, you know, any queen is going to be a woman. But the worst thing in the world that could happen was to have the ruler of your country as a woman. Knox thought that was about the worst thing in the world that could happen. He wrote a tract on it exposing the evils of it, which because nobody could publish for him in Scotland, he had published in Great Britain. He had it published in the year that Elizabeth was named queen, which she hardly ever forgave. It's interesting how those things go. The irony of it is that Knox could have used English help a lot a few years later, but he had a tough time getting it because Elizabeth remembered him as the man that, even though he wrote and said that he really only meant it for the Queen of Scotland, it was terrible to have a woman for the Queen of King, I mean for the ruler of Scotland. So sometimes the timing of the brethren in these things is not particularly adroit. Francis could tolerate the Protestants as long as they didn't rock the boat and as long as they were loyal Frenchmen. The Huguenot movement is a movement about which we know very little as far as its starting point is concerned. We really don't know what the name means. Well, that's the only reason I mention it on my notes. Really don't know what it means. Some think it was named for a French court and named Hugo. Nobody knows who he was. There are all sorts of things. Some think it's a crude jest on a French word, the cat. Nobody knows for sure. But the French Reformed Christians, let's just say the French Protestant Christians, let's say the French Evangelical Christians, how's that, of the Reformation period, quickly became known as Huguenots. And they did in France what Christians will do in other places. You know, they got converted and they decided to live in a community together. They soon had cities all over France which were just Huguenot cities. Only Huguenots lived there. Catholics could come there. Catholics conceivably could live there. But who wants to live in the middle of a bunch of rabble-rousers that are singing psalms all the time and inviting your kiddies to go to Bible club parties? Who wants to live in a place like that? So the Huguenots soon had cities, not giant ones at the time. Eventually they'll have large ones, but they soon had cities all over France. And the French cities, of course, were almost always walled cities. They were still living in the fear of the Vikings. The Vikings are pretty well gone. But they were still living in fortified cities to a large extent. You've heard about them barricading the streets in Dublin and Belfast. Haven't you heard? You've heard about those things, haven't you? See, if you live around Philadelphia and places like that, you can... Well, just look at Broad Street in Philadelphia. See, you can hardly imagine people... But we're used to these big, wide streets. When you visit the countries of Europe, some of you have been there, you visit the countries of Europe, you see these little narrow streets with almost no sidewalks and a brick building crowd on one good 8-foot Devon, and you could stop anybody from driving down the street. Make 5 Devons and 3 barrels of flour and a couple of bricks and you've got a fortress. And so they lived in a time when they feared for thieves. We think crime is bad today. Crime is child's play today compared to what it was in 1500 AD. It is child's play. Criminals know a little bit more and more of them are kung fu artists, I suppose. But just in terms of crime, you could hardly believe the social conditions of the world in 1500 AD. What's made the difference in the Western world has been the proclamation of the gospel and the effect it's had on the total society, both the people who were saved and the people who weren't saved. I've often mentioned Lefebvre, teaching University of Paris, with his evangelical doctrines, he was very popular with some students and unpopular with others. For a period of time at Paris, he had to hire a private bodyguard to escort him from classroom to classroom. Students wanted to kill him. They stood in the hall with clubs, kill him, kill him. See? Out would come 10 big bodyguards armed with pikes and swords in the middle of them, Jacques Lefebvre shuffling along and moving for the next class. We can hardly imagine circumstances like that. And we may get back to it. Now, every now and then I run into the doomsday people. They say, well, we don't see how things can be any worse than they are today. I'd just like to tell you that historically they have been, well, I think we're headed the wrong direction, you know. I think we're headed for heaven. But as far as the sociological condition, that's right. As far as the sociological condition of the world is concerned, I don't see it getting better and better. I see it getting worse almost every day. But it is still 100 times better than it was in Martin Luther's day. For almost everybody. Unless you're the Pope, it's always been pretty good for him. Almost anybody, it's 100 times better. Well, apart from that, see, in France, the cities, the Huguenots, soon had their cities. And these cities were fortified cities. Now, every now and then, a bishop in a section of France would decide to put them down, or the king or the queen of France would decide to do it, and so they would get the French army and go out to eliminate the Huguenots. Well, at that time, the Huguenots would wall up the city, load up the cannon, fight it off. Between 1560 and the end of the century, they had 8 major wars with the Huguenots, the French king just with the Huguenots. As soon as the Huguenots heard he was coming, they'd close up the gates and load up their cannon, and as a general rule, they won more than they lost. As a general rule. I don't think that there's any particular point in mentioning all the French kings who exist during this time. They are a sordid lot. The only competent person throughout the whole period is Catherine de' Medici. Catherine de' Medici is the wife of Henry II, who succeeded Francis, and then the mother of about the next 3 French kings. And she is an enormously competent person, hardly decent, but enormously competent. You know a difference between the two. Catherine de' Medici. She bitterly hated the Huguenots, not so much because she was a loyal Catholic, but because she saw in the Huguenots a threat to her children on the throne of France. She could see some Protestant rising up and saying, yeah, we've had enough masses in the palace. We ought to have a Protestant king for a while. And so she hated the Huguenots. She did sponsor in 1560 a big conference, like 1561 it might have been. The exact year is kind of beside the point, unless you're a real history buff. In 1561, she sponsored a big conference in Paris to try and get the Protestants and Catholics and French to talk together. Theodore Beza came from Geneva, but nothing was accomplished at it except they got madder at each other. And so following 1561, Catherine de' Medici and the French sons who followed her determined on various processes to eliminate the Huguenots. The most famous of those is the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Day. It's the 24th of August, 1572. In which the Catholic leaders and popes, I'm sorry, not popes, the Catholic leaders, bishops, kings, and rulers in France, determined to massacre as many Huguenots as they could. See, if you sent out an army, they walled up the city and started shooting off the wall at you. So they determined that they would massacre privately as many as they could on a particular day. And that day was the 24th of August, 1572. On that day, somewhere between, you know, this is absurd, but somewhere between 10 and 70,000 Huguenots were massacred that day. Most scholars think it was in the 30s. You just went out to the store to buy a loaf of bread, and you got inside, and suddenly the guy who was selling bread hit you with a meat cleaver. It was a bloodbath. The leaders of the Protestant movement, Admiral Coligny, don't worry about his name, and other men, were either assassinated or attempts were made in their lives. But in spite of the carnage, it just hardened the Huguenots. The Pope struck a medal in honor of it. In fact, several medals were struck in honor of it. Those things are very embarrassing to the Roman Church to this day. And the popular excuse is that the Pope really didn't understand what happened. He heard there had been a great conversion of Protestants, but the medal shows the French king with his sword whacking somebody. It doesn't look like he's knighting him. It's an interesting kind of circumstance. I was looking at pictures of the medals yesterday in Yeadon's church history, the Reformation period in Hubert Yeadon's church history, up here in the library. His pictures of the medal struck by the Pope and various other persons. But many thousands of Protestants were martyred. But that did not end their move. In fact, they grew stronger. Now, there happened about 1590 a very singular thing. Without all the details on these things, French got into a civil war in France between the successors to Francis I and those who pretended to want the French throne. The big controversy was between the House of Guise and the House of Bourbon in France. And that thing finally boiled down to a giant civil war in the 1580s that was eventually resolved about 1590 when Henry of Navarre, Navarre is N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Henry of Navarre, he will be called Henry the Fourth of France. Henry of Navarre, who was a Huguenot, got a sufficient force to defeat the various other claimants for the French crown. And so he moved on Paris, and he was informed that Paris would not receive him. It would be a bloodbath to take Paris. And so he did at that time, in 1590, he did an unusual thing. He left the Huguenot movement and became a Catholic, a Roman Catholic. He's reported to have said that Paris is worth a mass. In other words, to unite the French country without another big fight was worth saying mass once in a while. So Henry IV, who had a Huguenot background, a Reformed background, became Catholic and united the French under his banner. And then he gave to the Huguenots what is known as the Edict of Nantes in 1598, I think. But the Edict of Nantes guaranteed the Huguenots their personal freedom, it guaranteed them their religious freedom, it guaranteed them the right to have their own schools and to have their own fortified cities. And so the Huguenots accepted that. And the next nearly 100 years, till 1685, after Henry IV died, the next nearly 100 years would see continued efforts by various French leaders to lessen the power of the Huguenots. And eventually that would be accomplished so that in 1685, the Edict of Nantes would be revoked, the Huguenots would be put to bitter persecution and fighting, and more than 500,000 of them would flee France. 1685 to 1690. The significant thing in that is that the Huguenots were the big working class. They were not the wealthy landholders, nor were they the peasants. They were the trades and guilds people. And when they were driven from France, it left France with a polarized society of the very rich and the very poor. 1685. And that situation would become increasingly aggrieved until the breakout of the French Revolution in the 1780s, perhaps the most terrible social revolution the world has ever known. And so we've always said that the driving out of the Huguenots was really, in the long run, the ruin of France. Now, not all the Huguenots left. A few stayed. A few French Protestants remained. There's still a national church in France. It's very small. France is viewed as one of the big mission fields today. In the days of the French Revolution, the Roman Catholic Church would be declared illegal and Christianity would be outlawed. The French Revolutionary people, long time after the Reformation, the French Revolutionary people would kill thousands of priests, just pull them from their altars and chop their heads off. Better say hundreds. Teachers lie a lot, but hundreds. It was an enormous desecration of church and clergy during the French Revolution. Napoleon would eventually bring that to an end. But France would continue in a state of virtual atheism and agnosticism, and much of it down to this present day and age. Well, I think I need say nothing more there. Of course, for years, the Roman Church claimed every French citizen as a communicant. I've been to France for 3 days. Do you see how much I know? Nothing. I've had friends, though, that have lived their whole life there. I have some French people who are friends of mine, correspond from time to time, and many missionaries who've worked there in several different areas. And here's what they've all told me. They've all told me that although the Roman Church claimed all France, in the towns where they worked, not one Frenchman in 50 went to Mass. Now, I didn't count them, see, but that's what my friends have said with great friends who never met or knew each other. I'd say, well, it's really devout Roman Catholic. They'd say it's devout agnostic is what it is, they would say. Of course, the gospel gets people in all sorts of countries. I wanted to say a word about Poland. How's that? One word. Poland really almost became a Protestant country. By 1560, people say that about one-third of Poland was Protestant. But but in 1586, they brought to the throne a renegade Swedish king. He'd been kicked out of Sweden for being Catholic. They brought him to the throne in 1586. And he brought strong emphasis from the Jesuit order and other Catholic movements and military might, so that by 1600, Protestantism had been pretty well crushed in Poland. See, the Lord said he would build a church, but he didn't guarantee that he would build any one individual church. So either a nation or a local church can easily be lost if the people are not faithful and dedicated. Again, a tiny fragment survived in Poland, very tiny. And then a word about the Mediterranean countries. That, of course, would be Italy, the Western Mediterranean. There's no point talking about the Greek and the Albanian. They are under the Islamic rule at this time. Islam controls them tightly. They're fighting for their lives all the time. But the countries of Spain and Monte Carlo and the southern part of France, Bordeaux, and the territories in the northern part of Italy, and Italy itself. The Reformation message made almost no impact there at all. The only thing it did was it let it be known that there was a Reformed expression in the northern part of Europe. So lots of Italians and lots of Majorcans and people of that sort fled to Geneva and to Wittenberg and places like that. Lots of them did. And there was in the northern part of Italy at that time, still continuing, the old Waldensian church that I mentioned at the very start of this course. It gained some converts during this period. But the Reformation itself had almost no impact in the Mediterranean countries, except to lure out a few people to study in other parts of Europe. I was talking with you in the last class about the Reformation in England, and I had talked about the Reformation on some of the continental territories. I'd mentioned that it made almost no move at all in the Mediterranean countries. So I'll discuss with you then for a little while the Counter-Reformation. The Counter-Reformation was an informal response of the Roman authorities to the Reformation work, particularly in Germany and Central Europe. It had less impact in England, although it would have some there too. When I say that it was an informal response, I mean that there's no indication that they ever sat down, you know, like at the Vatican and spent hours and hours figuring out what to do. Just as the Reformation was kind of spontaneous, so the Counter-Reformation was rather spontaneous. Some aspects of it were planned, but most aspects of it just kind of happened because people don't like to be pushed into a particular mold. And just like some of the Lutherans revolted against the push of the Catholics, some of the Catholics revolted against the push of others. There's some certain stubbornness in us that makes us want to act in our own behalf somehow. I offer you a brief reminder on the Holy Roman Empire. The Holy Roman Empire was that paper empire. As far as we are concerned, its official creation dates back to about 964. Although it really never was exactly created, it just grew out of necessities. Just bear with me for a couple of minutes. Some of this is background and you can live without it. But after Rome fell, after Rome the city fell in 476, there was no official protection for the church on the Italian peninsula. And consequently, after two or three other things had been tried, it fell to the leadership of the Roman church, not only to promote themselves spiritually, or whatever you want to call it, but also politically. So the bishops of Rome, about 600 AD, began developing an army to protect themselves. That's reasonable. Rome was a very well-walled city. Territories around it were well-fortified. So at about 600, they began developing an army to protect themselves. However, it was still a little territory. The states around Rome were a little territory, about the size of Rhode Island, if you please. So it was not a big place. And the barbarians were enormous in the world. Thousands of barbarians. There was no good reason for staying home. They weren't all like Santa Claus dropping packages on little children. They would swoop through the Mediterranean world in particular. The barbarians from Denmark were big for this sort of thing. It was nice. In winter Denmark, they were swooping through the Mediterranean, robbing and stealing like Hagar the Horrible and all of that sort of thing. Plus the fact there were Vandals out of North Africa and out of Sicily. So that Rome, the Italian peninsula, was fair game for a lot of what we would call a barbarian warfare today, a guerrilla warfare. So that even though the bishops of Rome established their own armies, those armies were not adequate for total protection of the city. Well, in the 8th century, in a very crude way, in the 8th century, the bishop of Rome got into a kind of an agreement with the king of France that he would recognize the king of France as king of all the French territories, and the king of France in return would give him some territory in Italy and give him some military protection so that his domain would not be overrun. And then out of that beginning developed in time the Holy Roman Empire. Now Charlemagne was announced in 800 to be the king of all the Romans. It was purely a paper title, but he was announced that in 800. And in 964, the existing pope at that time, John the 12th, crowned Otto of Germany, Holy Roman Emperor. Purely a paper title. The idea was that these countries were loyal to the faith of the Western Church and would help the Bishop of Rome if he were attacked by vandals or other characters. Now, about half the time, the Bishop of Rome needed help to keep from being attacked by them. So if he did that, then he had to find it somewhere else. So the idea developed that all of the countries of Europe that were loyal to the Western Church constituted an empire, Roman because the church was located in Rome, holy because it was spiritual in character, supposedly. And the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire was a figure who conceivably could call on all of the other nations to give him help if the religious orders of his day were threatened. But he had no special territory. There was no place you could go to and somebody would say, well, this is the Holy Roman Empire. Any Catholic country, let's say any country loyal to the Western Church, was thought of as belonging to that empire. But you couldn't go any place and say, well, take me to the land of the Holy Roman Empire. The guide would have looked and he said, well, you're standing on it. It's all around you. So that's about all you could say. So the concept was that all of the countries of Europe that had previously or thought they were loyal to the Western Church faith, that they constituted the Holy Roman Empire. Now, when Protestantism began to develop in Germany and then in Switzerland and France, eventually in England, when Protestantism began to develop, what it was, first of all, was a threat to the empire more than it was to the church, because it tended to tear away big sections of territory from the empire. See, they were now free from the church and free from the empire. So Protestantism was a big threat, or call it what you want. Protestantism, evangelicalism is a better term. But evangelicalism was a big threat to the empire, as well as a threat to the existing church of its time. Forgot the word for church. Big problem to the empire, as well as a problem to the existing church of its time. But what it meant was that Protestantism would have to be dealt with some way. Otherwise, the whole empire idea might collapse, and there'd be nobody to have all this prestige and power. If the Turks would attack Rome, who would go down and defend it? Luther probably would not. He probably would have sent the Turks a telegram saying, fight on, men, or something like that. So it was a considerable problem. But there were a number of problems that prevented the Counter-Reformation from really moving quickly. See, it's not a consolidated force any more than the Roman Empire was. It just springs up here and there. But there are a number of problems that prevented it from moving quickly. One was these national rivalries. They can't be stressed too much. The English did not trust the French across as far as the English Channel was wide, and with good cause, and the French trusted the English even less and with better cause. But the rivalries were intense. Spain and France, England and France, Germany and France and Spain, the rivalries were intense. So any move of counter-reform was thought of only in the light of whether it would hurt your nationality or not. And consequently, the King of France, first Francis I, and then later Henry II, the King of France, on two occasions, was the sole human cause why the Reformation was not overthrown by the counter-reformed armies. That's because the Catholic King of France thought it would work better for his nationality if he withdrew his forces and attacked the emperor with them, see? He wanted France to be strong. He didn't give a hoot about the church if you got real sticky about it. Likewise, England. England, up until the time of Henry VIII, England was one of the most ferociously loyal Catholic countries that there was in all of Europe. But England was essentially for England. It was a little country, but it was essentially for England. Consequently, not willing to cooperate with the emperor in any of his plans for overthrowing the Protestants, unless it was guaranteed that England would be greater when it was over than they were at the start. And the poor emperor, Charles V, through most of this time, he actually comes to the throne during the Reformation, but the poor emperor, he is king of the largest countries in Europe. He is the most powerful Roman emperor, he's the most powerful emperor in Europe from Charlemagne. Probably from Charlemagne to Napoleon, there's no one that approaches him for strength. He is king of two of the richest countries in Europe, he's got the biggest armies, but he's got all of these other Catholic countries snapping at his heels because they don't want him to get too big for their britches, his britches. And that's particularly true of the Pope. The Pope is fearful that the emperor will get too powerful, and then he'll decide to investigate the problems in the papacy, and he'll send an army down there and arrest the old duffer while they investigate things. And who knows what would happen with an imperial army in Rome. So the work of the Counter-Reformation was held back very much by this nationalism, and held back also by the distrust of the conciliar system, as I mentioned on my notes. Held back by the distrust of the conciliar system. The conciliar system, from earlier in the semester, in this present age, was started when the church held a council at Constance in 1415, 1416. And that council removed three people from office who claimed to be popes. And it appointed Martin V to be the next pope, and he held the chair of Rome in spite of all these rivals. But the idea that a council could take you out of office filled the church and filled its chief leaders with a fear for that kind of activity. A couple of weeks ago, we had a visit here by the man who's guiding us on our accreditation campaign with the Middle States Accrediting Association. He's a really pleasant fellow. He's a professor of something or other at some church up in Brooklyn or the Bronx or some other foreign country where the barbarians roam free. But he's really a very pleasant man and very helpful to us. But if you want to see the old boys shape up, let them know that the head of the accrediting committee is going to visit their class. Let them know that. Even I shape up at a time like that. See, start on time, stop on time, stick to the guts and all that sort of thing. There's just something built into us that fills us with a kind of an awe of an authority that holds the power of, quote, life or death over us. You must know that. And so in this situation, the popes distrusted the conciliar movement. Luther kept pleading for a council. The chances are if they'd had a council in, say, 1517, when Luther wanted it, just take that for a round year, the chances are if they'd had a council in 1517, the first thing that would have happened is that Luther would have been arrested and put in a dungeon and executed. That's probably the first thing that would have happened. But the pope of that time, Leo X, feared the conciliar system and didn't trust it, and he would not give his backing to a council. The emperor wanted one, too. But you know, the pope had to get the clerics to come, and he was absolutely unwilling to do it. And then the third thing that interfered with Counter-Reformation was what I referred to in my notes as a lack of strict uniformity. Today, the Roman Church has changed in the last 20 years. I have certain prejudices you'll have to forgive me for them. I don't think it's changed for the better. If any of you have a Roman background or if any of you are involved in those things right now, just forgive my prejudices for a moment. I don't think it's changed for the better, but it's changed a lot. When I was a youth, all the masses were in Latin, for example. The masses today in this country are now mostly in English. And a lot of other things have changed, too. All the ladies wear big mantillas. Today, most of them don't even bother with wigs. It's interesting how those things go. So I'm just saying that there have been big changes in the framework of it. But when I was younger, and when you were younger, too, a great sameness marked the Roman Church. The Mass was just about the same everywhere. It was always in Latin. I mean, you could go to Mass in the Netherlands or in South Philadelphia or in Western Pennsylvania and hear the same service. You might not understand it, but you would hear the same service. Now see, that's altered today. If you go in South Philadelphia, it might be in Italian. If you go in Western Pennsylvania, it might be Polish and various other things too. And there will be still some parts in Latin, but that freedom is there. But there was a great sameness to the Roman Church. That sameness, however, did not exist before the Reformation. Before the Reformation, there was wide divergency in it. Some of the monastic orders were really rather evangelical. The one to which Luther belonged was a monastic order that concentrated on Bible study. The Eremite Brethren of St. Augustine. They concentrated on Bible study. I hardly knew. It's easy to make yourself sound like you know everybody in the world. I don't know. There's millions of people I never met. But I did know lots of Catholic scholars. I used to go to school with them in the various grad programs and whatnot. Lots of Catholic scholars. Some really fine men and some very fine women, too. But I hardly knew any of them that had concentrated on Bible study except for the catechetical learning that they had to pick up with the church. If you got beyond the catechetical learning in the Bible, well, they just didn't go there. That just didn't follow that way. And part of that was because, to a large extent, the laity was not trusted to study the Bible and not really heavily encouraged to do it. Today, there's quite a swing. Now, that swing might work for the better. If people read the scriptures, the scriptures will do them some good. So that swing might be an improvement, I suppose. But there used to be a great, well, moving away from that sort of thing. The Baltimore Catechism has always, for 200 years, 100, not two, as long as it's been around, 185, 95, whatever, the Baltimore Catechism always gave a special dispensation for the reading of scriptures. But I have sat and talked with at least 30 devout Catholics who didn't realize that. And when I would say, why didn't they read the scriptures more, that the catechism gave them the special dispensation for reading them, they just were utterly unaware of that. I used to have that page in my Baltimore catechism worn out. I've always felt that people read the scriptures, really read them, the scriptures will get to them in time. I don't care where they are, whether it's you, me, or somebody else. I've always felt that's a big thing if they really read them. But if you just read about them or hear other people's opinions on them or sit and listen to guys like me lecture, it may not do much for you at all in time. But those things all interfered with any real strong effort on a counter-reformation. So that will allow me to go to page 12 and talk with you about some of the major moves in the counter-reform. some of the major moves. Now, the biggest single move of all was the Society of Jesus, or the Jesuit Order. It was not planned by the church. It happened by accident. It happened out of the life of Ignatius, who lived in a town of Loyola, and consequently he is called Ignatius Loyola. When I was in the army, I had a friend named Peter Thorslev. His father was a Danish Lutheran pastor in the town of Thorslev. And I said to Peter, I said, what is your surname? He said, it's Thorslev, he said. T-H-O-R-S-L-E-V. Thorslev, he said. And I said, but that's the name of the town. Yes, that's right, he said. Everyone who's born in that town is so-and-so Thorslev. I said, there must be hundreds of you. Well, he said, there are only about 300 people in the whole town. But he said, everybody is Thorslev. He said, some get anglicized, Americanized, and whatnot. He said, they want to call themselves John Smith of Thorslev, things like that. But he said, my family has always preferred the old customs. And he said, I'm Peter of Thorslev. And he said, my sister is Joanna of Thorslev. And my father is whatever his father's name was, I don't remember now, and all that sort of thing. And I said, well, I would have been, no, no. He said, there's only one Peter of Thorslev, he said. He said, there are lots of names for boys. Not the other women didn't have to name their sons Peter. It's interesting how it goes, I suppose. But that's what it was with Ignatius. Ignatius was from essentially a town of Loyola, and he is called St. Ignatius Loyola. And his memory is pretty highly revered in the Roman Church to this day. He was born in 1491 and died about 1556. The exact dates are not important, but it is nice for you to see that he's roughly a contemporary of Calvin and Luther. A little less than Zwingli, because Zwingli died early. But he's roughly a contemporary of Calvin and Luther. He's a Spaniard. And I can't say much about his life except to tell you that originally he was a soldier. Loyola was one of those men who had the burning desire to do things well. That's about all you can say. He was consumed with excelling at whatever he did. And he was determined to be a great soldier. He was in the army of Charles V. He had a minor command role. He was determined to be a great soldier. And then in one of the sieges fighting the King of France, he was wounded in the leg and was lame for the rest of his life. In those days, a lot of the soldiery was done with swords, you know, jump around, jab, and stab. But Loyola was lamed, and consequently he was rendered unfit for military service the rest of his life. Crushed and disappointed, texts tell us, that he went and dedicated his skills in his life. He took his sword and the other military things and laid them at a statue of the Virgin Mary, and said that since he could not be the great soldier for the armies and the emperor, he would become a great soldier for the church. And so he entered the monastic life, the study life. He was such a diligent student, Loyola was, that they got suspicious of him, and some of his colleagues tried to report him to the Inquisition. They thought anybody that studied that hard, there must be something wrong with it. So he actually found a little difficulty at going in his own group. But in a nutshell, he disciplined himself to make himself a powerful sort of organizer of religious ideals. And so in 1522, he was in the Dominican monasteries, and just the dates are not very important, but 1528, just about Calvin's time at the University of Paris. And the historical texts all tell us that his total giving himself to the church gave him the sort of peace that he wanted. But you know, he found the monasteries not to be the sort of thing he wanted. He found a monastery life that he lived leisurely, casually. Some of the monks hardly went to prayers. Here's a guy who's down to earth, brass tacks. He wants to memorize 10 Bible verses a day, and in the monastery they can't even find him a Bible. See, he's disgusted with it beyond belief. And so about 1534, he banded together a small company of people who would follow with him, a small militant company of people. They would give themselves totally to Jesus. They would be called the Society of Jesus. He insisted on rugged spiritual training for them. There were no softies in the Jesuits, no softies. Although everything changes, that is still more true today than of any Catholic order I know anything about.
This series is continued on the next cassette. Other helpful cassettes are available from Biblical Theological Seminary. For a free cassette catalog or more information about the seminary, please write to Biblical Theological Seminary, 200 North Main Street, Hatfield, Pennsylvania, zip code 19440.